We do a lot of monetary policy on this show, interest rates and the Fed. Today, we dip a toe into the fiscal side. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 26th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It was busy down at the White House today. President Yoon of South Korea is in town, so there was security everywhere, vans and buses and SUVs shuttling delegations all over the place. In the relative calm of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, though, right next door to the White House, we got some time with Lael Brainard, who, until a couple of months ago, was the vice chair of the Federal Reserve, now the director of the National Economic Council. So I asked her, just as a place to start, how she likes her new job.
You know, it's busy, and I really enjoy it.
Let me dig into that a little bit, because you've been doing monetary policy now for 9+ years at the Fed, and here you are now in fiscal policy land. And I wonder how that's different for you.
Look, for me, it is a chance to really make a huge difference in terms of the supply side of the economy. So the president has a investing in America agenda that is transformative. It's really has the power to reindustrialize the U.S. economy, to put us on a clean energy path, and to create hundreds of thousands of good-paying jobs all around the country. So that agenda will really lead to a much more resilient supply side of our economy and put us on a track for strong growth for years to come.
So we had Secretary Raimondo on the program yesterday. Talked about that actually for the whole interview, right? What is going to happen in industrial policy in this country? I do wonder, though, if given the current state of things in Congress, we're kind of done with fiscal policy in this country for the next 2 years, and you now have to manage implementation.
So it is absolutely the case that we had three historic pieces of legislation, and the focus now is on making sure that those historic bills really show up in terms of opportunities for communities all across the country, including communities that have been left behind. And it's opportunities to be part of industries that are going to be important for the future.
Let me ask you, though, when we had Cecilia Rouse, and I hate to name drop, but we did have her on the program like a year and a half ago, right, when she was on the Council of Economic Advisors, the chair. I asked her about the fiscal inputs from the Biden administration and inflation. And I wonder how worried you are now that as this $3 trillion flows through the economy, it's going to make the Fed's fight against inflation all the tougher.
I really am not worried at all. I don't think that
that is not
where this historic legislation is really going to have an impact. They're going to lead to a much more resilient domestic clean energy infrastructure and a very strong domestic manufacturing supply chain for semiconductors. Those are two of the main constraints that led to high inflation during the last few years. Of course, we're also seeing inflation coming down pretty rapidly now.
We are, and you're right to point that out. I do wonder, though, what you're looking at now as you look at this economy. Are you looking at inflation? Are you looking at the labor market? What are your markers? I mean, you're a trained observer of this economy.
Yeah. So looking across the economy, we are transitioning to sustainable, stable growth. We see a labor market that has been recovering very rapidly, and that is going to transition to a more sustainable pace. But in terms of the improvements there, 12.5 million new jobs over 2 years, record low unemployment, and participation, importantly, among working age Americans is now greater than it was pre-pandemic.
I'm sure it hasn't escaped your notice, though, that first-time claims for unemployment are up and continuing claims have now been trending up for, I think it's 6 months.
Yeah, so as the transition to more stable growth, which is important because we want to have low inflation, while we also keep unemployment low, that transition is going to be important to continuing to see progress on inflation and to see more moderation in the labor market. And that's what we're starting to see for precisely the data that you're referring to, suggests a labor market that's coming into better balance.
Let me tick through a couple of specific issue areas. I want to talk banking, and I don't want to know if you think banking is stable, because your answer will be yes. I want to know what you're expecting on Friday when the Fed's report on Silicon Valley Bank and supervision comes out. You did a lot of banking supervision at the Fed. You have spoken out against some of the relaxation of the rules. I wonder what you're expecting that report to say.
So I don't know what that report will say. I'm no longer at the Fed. Mm-hmm. And of course, I have no insights into that. But I do know...
Oh, wait. You must have some insights, right?
I don't have any insights into
the report,
to what their report might say.
But generally, banking supervision and the state of banking?
So what happened, I think, over the course of the Trump administration is there was a kind of broad effort to both relax rules and relax supervision, particularly for banks... of the sort of Silicon Valley and Signature. And I think that's what we saw as interest rates rose. Some of those weaker rules and weaker supervision really came home to roost in particular banks who were poorly managed and taking unacceptable risks. So I think we will see continued tightening or retightening of the rules that were relaxed just for those mid-sized regional banks to make sure that they have liquidity requirements. They're testing their liquidity, that they are stress tests. Silicon Valley was never stress tested. It was over $200 billion in assets. It never got stress tested, and it was not stress tested for interest rate increases, which would have shown a lot of the holes in the balance sheet that were in the end, very destructive.
Supervisory failure, do you think?
So I think in terms of supervision, we certainly need to see that relaxation reversed, and we need to make sure that senior executives are held accountable, that they know they need to risk manage those banks tightly, or that supervisors will call them on it and it will have consequences.
We'll pick it up right there with Lael Brainard later on in the program. The global economy, the debt limit, a little bit more than that as well. On Wall Street today, kind of a split decision, actually. But to that bit that Dr. Brainard was just talking about, banks and supervision, trading in shares of First Republic, it of the $100 billion in deposit withdrawals in the fourth quarter, as we mentioned yesterday, trading in ticker symbol FRC was halted 16 times today. To try to get a handle on some really volatile trading. All the same, FRC ended the session down another 29%. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Good news about this economy today comes to us via the manufacturing sector. Orders for durable goods, big expensive things like cars and appliances, machinery too, and aircraft, they were up 3.2% in March. Quite the turnaround, one must say, from just a couple of months ago. Durables orders were down 5% in January. But I know I said this was today's economics bright spot, but as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, today's bright, shiny headline number on this might be just slightly less than actually meets the eye.
That 3.2% increase in durable goods orders for March sure is big. But there's a major caveat. It's driven by one really volatile variable, commercial aircraft. One plane can cost well over $100 million. Boeing booked 38 new orders in March, leading to an 80% jump in a single month.
So it requires us to look under the hood every month to see what's actually happening.
Dan North at credit insurer Allianz Trade says strip out volatile transportation orders down to what's called core non-defense capital goods, and last month was a whole lot less impressive.
That number was actually down 0.4%, and it's been down 4 out of the past 5 months. And why do we look at non-defense capital goods? Well, it's really a good proxy for business spending.
Spending on new machinery, computers, automation. In other words, businesses investing in the future. And when they cut back sharply, it's a warning, says Andrew Hunter at Capital Economics.
The fact that it now seems to be weakening and has been weakening for the past couple of quarters now is unfortunately a sign, I think, that economic growth is heading lower.
Now, to put this in context, manufacturing is only about 1/8 of the economy. So Brad McMillan at Commonwealth Financial Network says it's possible to have a manufacturing slump
and still see the economy as a whole continue to grow.
And back to those rockstar aircraft orders we started with, McMillan says they're volatile, sure, but they do tell us something important about the economy.
Airlines are feeling pretty positive, both about where they are and about the future.
He points out, though, in the past, airlines haven't always been great at predicting the economic future. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Today's tech news is from the Competition and Markets Authority over in the UK, kind of their Federal Trade Commission / antitrust watchdog, which has blocked Microsoft's $69 billion takeover of Activision Blizzard. Activision Blizzard, of course, the company behind a whole slew of video games from Call of Duty to Candy Crush. Microsoft, via the Xbox, is the distribution channel, and regulators over in the UK say that would wind up giving gamers fewer choices. But that is not the story we are going to cover. We are going to point out that the UK is now almost 7 years out from its decision to leave the European Union. So we sent Marketplace's Lily Jamali off today to report on the business climate in the UK of late.
To help this merger through, Microsoft had already committed to keeping various existing games on competing platforms for a period of time, says Nicholas Economides of NYU Stern. But he says future content remains a concern for regulators.
So Activision might produce a new game, and Microsoft has not made a commitment about new games.
The UK isn't alone in having concerns about competition. The US sued to block the mega merger last year. But the UK has some unique economic challenges right now, says Rita McGrath of Columbia Business School.
The mood is not good. And Brexit, for a lot of people, has had a lot of economic consequences they're not very happy with.
Today's stagnant UK economy, with consumers dealing with inflation and a rollback of public services, has fallen short of what Brexiteers promised. And Peter Holmes of the UK Trade Policy Observatory says blocking this merger goes against the spirit of Brexit.
In a Brexit world, you rein back on regulating business. You let them merge, you let them do what they like, and you trust in competition.
Brexit left the UK to make such calls on its own, says Ian Begg of the London School of Economics. Begg says the decision is less about Brexit than efforts by Britain to develop lucrative industries.
The government is putting a lot of money on the idea of having a high-tech sector in the UK.
Microsoft plans to appeal the UK regulator's decision. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up,
holding the U.S. economy hostage is going to be very, very disruptive.
Oh, yes, it is. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, down about 228 today, 0.7%, closed at 33,301. The NASDAQ gained 55 points, almost a half percent, 11,854. The S&P 500 down 15 points, almost 0.4%, 4,055. Mitchell was talking about durable goods orders rising, thanks in part to aircraft. Boeing, which released earnings today, lifted 0.4%. Lockheed Martin down 2.9%. Raytheon Technologies dipped about 3.4%. Rail company Norfolk Southern said the February derailment that spilled toxic chemicals in East Palestine, Ohio, cost $387 million. Cleanup is ongoing. The company reported $466 million in earnings this quarter. That is down from more than $700 million a year ago. Norfolk Southern down 2.9% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As promised, more now from Lael Brainard, the director of the National Economic Council, part two, America in the World.
The global economy, as you know, the International Monetary Fund came out with its forecast, what, a week, 10 days ago. The lowest median term forecast for growth in 30 years, right? 3% globally. What's your sense of stability and growth in the global bank and the global economy today?
So, you know, we are also seeing some cross currents there. On the one hand, China is coming back, but rebounding perhaps with not quite as much momentum as some observers mm-hmm. were expecting. And of course, China, you know, has been a very important contributor to global growth. And here in the U.S., which we are also a very important part of global growth, we're transitioning to more stable growth. So if you look across the world, we're seeing some moderation in global growth, but there are reasons to think that, at least in the U.S. case, we will see that transition taking place relatively smoothly.
You know, it's interesting. You say cross currents in a very academic and lawyerly way, no offense intended. I wonder if you could explain to people listening to this what those cross currents in the global economy are. What do you see? This is your job.
So in terms of what are the risks that are out there, obviously for a number of countries that experienced high inflation due to the pandemic, due to the war, they raised interest rates, and those interest rate increases start to weigh on activity. And of course, you have countries like China who were very slow to lift restrictions associated with COVID. And so they're only just starting to return to normal levels of economic activity. Here in the U.S., of course, we also have some political risks to our outlook. And of course, the most important of those is the fight over the debt limit.
So let's go there. And thank you for going to my next question on my list. At some point, the president's going to come to you, if he hasn't already, and say, Lael, what do I do?
So in terms of the president's approach on this, I think it's been clear. It is to say we need to lift the debt limit. We need to suspend the debt limit. We can't threaten to take the U.S. economy into default. And separately, we need to sit down with Congress, as is always the case, to have regular order negotiations over the budget. So I think that's the two-track. Now, why is it so important to avoid default? It's important because even playing brinksmanship with default, calling into question the full faith and credit of the U.S. government is enormously destabilizing to financial markets. And of course, it is not intended to be used for extortion. It's good to negotiate, but the negotiation takes place every year over the budget. What we can't see is that the debt limit be used by a part of Congress to hold an entire agenda of unrelated items hostage to this threat of default.
Why do you think the market hasn't reacted yet? Because that's what's going to concentrate the minds, right?
So I think we are starting to see some observers taking a look and noticing that this question about holding the U.S. economy hostage is going to be very, very disruptive. And so you're starting to see some of the financial market indicators flashing yellow. And I think it will become rapidly clear as people focus on exactly when the debt limit could be reached. I think you'll start to see financial markets reacting much more strongly. And again, there's no need for that. What is the normal course is to simply take the threat of default off the table and negotiate in good faith on the budget, which is going to be a compromise. That, I think, is just the regular order way to handle the nation's finances in a responsible manner.
Lael Rayner, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Almost no matter the workplace, being in charge isn't easy. That is true for companies, and it's true for school districts. Superintendents have to run budgets and hire and fire staff and be the public face of the district. And we need more of them. At least 30% of the country's superintendents have quit in the past 3 years. That's according to an education executive search firm. And it's a staffing crisis that has far-reaching ramifications for district budgets, for district staff, and also for its students. So at least half the states are trying to create a pipeline of superintendent candidates. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports from Maryland's Eastern Shore.
At an inn near the Chesapeake Bay, a group of about 16 people from around Maryland are gathered in a small ballroom. It's the state's first ever aspiring superintendent academy. Many of the attendees are career educators, even assistant superintendents, but the lead role has new challenges, a panel of current superintendents is telling them, like working with school board members who may be upset about curriculum choices or individual teachers. Dave Bromwell, who leads the district in Dorchester County, says he tries to be a buffer between his staff and the board.
So what I've tried to do is say, look, I'm your employee. So if you're mad about something and you think someone's not doing their job, that's what I'm for. I got big shoulders. I can take it. Let me have it.
It's also important not to take all of that personally, says another superintendent, Patty Salins. She has a different warning. There will be lawsuits.
You're just going to be sued all the time. Yep. You have all litigation all the time. It happens.
The academy was planned by the state's member association for superintendents and is meeting about 10 times. The need for people who want to do this is urgent. Mary Pat Fannin, the association's executive director, points out that about a third of the state's 24 superintendent positions were up for grabs last year.
It would be lovely to not feel anxious when there's 9 openings, right? Like, I know there's a little cohort of superintendent wannabes out there.
The money for the training comes from the U.S. Department of Education, the State Superintendent Association, and the school districts themselves. And learning about money is key to the training. It's one thing to be a teacher. It's another to know how to budget for a school system. Again, Superintendent Dave Bromwell.
Are you providing staff with the tools they need to make our students successful? And then in doing that, what dollar signs attach to that?
There can't be enough financial education for superintendents who are wrangling budgets that are often in the tens of millions of dollars and can be over $1 billion in the biggest districts. Marguerite Rosa is with the Edgenomics Lab at Georgetown.
Managing these mega budgets in the private sector, you know, involves a whole career path. You can imagine becoming a superintendent and actually not having had ownership over public resources in any significant amount before.
The median salary for a superintendent is around $156,000, according to the National Membership Association. But people with these skills can make much more, say, running a big company. Ray & Associates is a national search firm that consults with school boards to find superintendents. The firm doesn't track how many people who take part in these trainings go on to actually fill the roles. But Molly Schwartzhoff, the search firm's vice president, says when a district can't find a superintendent, there's a snowball effect.
We're seeing combined school districts, which then raises class sizes. Teachers get overwhelmed. We're already seeing the burnout. It's a huge impact on our kids and on our education system if we don't have enough people to lead these districts.
Which is why Maryland is training people like Monique Jackson. She's a deputy superintendent in Anne Arundel County Public Schools and part of the aspiring superintendent cohort. She has a great aunt who ran an elementary school in what was then a segregated state and comes from a long line of other educators.
I hope if they were here today still, they would have that pride for the things that I've done.
But Jackson is still squaring the time required and the scrutiny that could come to both her and her family if she takes on the job. Her kids are now 11 and 13.
They don't know anything other than mommy being at central office. And so that's why this is not just a decision for me.
One thing Jackson likes about the training is getting to know other educators from around the state. Mary Pat Fannin of the Maryland Superintendent Association says the job can be lonely. And she wants these aspiring leaders to have colleagues they can turn to if they take the leap. In Queen Anne's County, Maryland, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I meant to get these points into a question to Lael Brainard earlier today, but I guess it got away from me. A quick one, too, on economic data out the next couple of days. Our first look at first quarter gross domestic product growth comes tomorrow. Consensus is about 2% growth annualized, of course, January through March.
And then Friday is the biggie, inflation, the way the Fed likes to measure it, personal consumption expenditure, PCE, 8:30, Friday morning, Washington time. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. We are going to stick with a calendar theme here. Next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, the Fed meets. What do you think? Quarter of a percentage point? Maybe a pause? I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry. I don't know why I laughed at that. Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.